When I started this 2 weeks ago, I was not planning to do a series of sermons, but it turns out that it's working out that way. You remember 2 weeks ago, we talked about the need of the human heart for transformation. The human heart, the way it is issued out of the body, is self-interested. And it's God's project so far 6,000 years to get His Torah written on our hearts, and He's still working on us. We talked about what defines insanity. Insanity, from our perspective, is somebody who believes in something that's not real. From the world's perspective, insanity is someone who tries to put a restraint on what people want. So the left in this country regards us as right-wing nut jobs, which is to say insane. We look at them and they say, you're crazy. And there isn't anything in between. So we talked about that. Then last week, we talked about how God transforms people, the process that He goes through. We talked about how He teaches, which is what the Torah is teaching, instruction. We talked about how He puts people under trial, test them, you know, check the product. So He tested Abraham, He tested Jacob, He will test Joseph, He will test Judah. He tests everybody. And He chastens, which is to say, when you fail a test, He will correct you, sometimes not very pleasantly. Nobody likes to be chastened, but He will do that for you. And then finally, there's suffering. And what suffering does is toughens you up, produces character. And the example I used was a football coach who makes his players suffer in order to get them to be tough and get them to do what they need to do on game day. So suffering is part of character development. Well, as you remember last time, we finished up with Jacob. Jacob's still alive, he's not dead, but the story now shifts to Joseph and Judah. And what we're going to see is the transformation of Joseph and Judah over the next couple of weeks. Joseph's problem is pride, and Judah's problem is resentment, which is also pride. Because when you're resentful, what that means is somebody who has done something to your personal self that is just horrible and you can't forgive. So both Judah and Joseph have got a pride problem. And what's going to happen over the next several weeks is God is going to deal with their pride in different ways. And we saw that start today. In the case of Joseph, he gets thrown into a pit. He gets shipped down and becomes a slave. He gets unjustly accused. He gets tested with temptation. He gets thrown into a pit again. By the way, you notice that all of those things are things we talked about last week that God uses to develop character. So Joseph, at the beginning of the story, is a callow young man. And that's almost redundant because young men are by definition pretty callow. He's the favorite of his father. He's the firstborn of his mother. He's given a visible mark of favor, which is this coat that he wears. And he's given dreams of dominion. So it's obvious to Joseph that he's going to rule over everything. And he sort of acts that way. Now, remember that he is quite a number of years younger than his oldest brothers. Because we remember the incident of competitive childbearing in Haran, where Jacob had four wives working on the job, but it still takes 9 months per baby. Judah had four women on the job, and he comes up with children, the last of which, except for Benjamin, is Joseph. So he is by far the youngest, and his older brothers are a number of years older than he is, and you know, more mature and so forth. So for this young guy to be prancing around in his fancy coat, checking on his brothers for his father, and generally being an obnoxious 18-year-old, you can see how that sort of annoys them. They are so annoyed, in fact, that they are willing to kill him. And Reuben has an attack of conscience and realizes that as the firstborn, he's going to be responsible. So he short-circuits killing him, and he's off doing something else, and Judah says, let's don't kill him, let's go ahead and sell him. So he does. So at the end of that episode, the two kingly lines of Israel are lost. Joseph is dead, quote unquote, which is to say he's off in Egypt, Judah has left the family. Judah has pulled an Esau. He has married a local woman. He has separated himself from the family. He's off doing his own thing. And the rabbinic interpretation of that is when the other brothers saw how upset Jacob was about this whole thing, they all turned on Judah and said, "It's all your fault." And Judah says, "Eh," and leaves. So at this point, we have the two kingly lines, the two royal lines, Joseph and Judah, and they're both separated. And the next several weeks, that process of bringing that all back together and developing the character of those two men is what we're going to see. So we'll start with Joseph. Remember I said his problem is pride. And he is a spoiled 18-year-old. That's just the way he is. And perfectly normal, perfectly natural, needs to be corrected. So God takes the process of correction into his own hands, because apparently Jacob is not going to do it. So the first thing he does is he chastens Joseph. His brothers throw him into a pit, separate him from his father, who is his source of support and power, and then they send him to Egypt. So what he's doing first off is he's being chastened for being so arrogant. And when he gets to Egypt, he prospers. He gets good at what he's doing. He's a good manager. He's a good businessman, if you will. Then he gets tested. Remember the process that God uses, chastening, testing? He gets tested. And that's what the Potiphar's wife business is all about. Testing him. See how the product is coming. Then he suffers. He gets thrown into the pit unjustly. And then by the time he comes out of the pit, he has had a long time, 20 some odd years, to build up a resume. He has become a mature man. There is no way that God is going to turn the viceroyship of Egypt with all the grain in the world over to a callow 18-year-old inexperienced guy. It's just not going to happen. So what God does is it takes him through a process by which he matures him and wrings the pride out of him, so that by the time Pharaoh hauls him up out of the pit, he is a man of substance and is perfectly capable of taking on the mission that Pharaoh and God give him. So that's the process of character development of Joseph. And as I've said before, when Joseph finally forgives his brothers, that is the first instance of forgiveness in human literature anywhere. Certainly the first instance in the Bible, but according to Rabbi Sacks, it's also the first instance of forgiveness anywhere in human history, when he finally forgives his brothers. So you can see then the transformation that is happening to Joseph over a 20-year period. As I say, he becomes a man of considerable substance, whereas before he was a prideful, callow youth. So let's talk about pride, since that's what's being corrected right now. The definition of pride is an inappropriate focus on your own heart. Let that sink in for a minute. Because remember, what we've been talking about for the last 3 weeks is the idea that the human heart, as it is issued from its mother, is self-interested, not especially appealing, and it needs to be trained over a period of years. And the whole purpose of this part of your life is to transform your heart so that when you go into the next part of your life, after you pass through physical death, you will have some character that is pleasing to God. That's the whole purpose of all this stuff that you're going through. So pride, then, by definition, is listening to your heart. Your heart is the number one thing that you're listening to, and that, by the way, guides all of your actions. It focuses on you. That's the definition of pride. Notice that I said it's inappropriate focus on your heart. There's a qualifier there. You don't get rid of your heart. The things that you love, the things that you care about, the things that you want, they'll go away. They simply are put in proper perspective to the society you live in and to God's Word. So the idea here is you get rid of that inappropriate focus on your heart and you use your heart for what it was designed to do, not to guide your life without any training. So there's a range. I'm now speaking Musar. For those of you who have been through the Musar course, you'll realize this. On one end of the spectrum is arrogance. That's pretty much what Joseph was at the beginning. At the other end of this spectrum is what's called self-abasement. Most people don't think of self-abasement as pride, but it is. It is an inappropriate focus on you. You think that you're lowly and a worm and not worth anything and not good for anything. You're focusing on you. So that is every bit as much pride as arrogance is pride. It's just the other end of the spectrum. And then in the middle, you've got something that is healthy. And you want to be in the middle. You want to be in the healthy range. So one of the things that Musar does is starts its training with pride. And the reason for that is because pride affects how you see everything else. So if you are proud and arrogant, why should I be grateful when you do something nice for me? I deserve it. Skews your view of gratitude. Patience. Well, why should I be patient? I'm the most important thing here. You ought to do it now when I need it done. It skews your view of patience. Generosity. Why should I give anything to you? It's all mine. I deserve it. So your view of pride skews everything else in your life. So that's why we start with pride, and that's why we're talking about pride. Now, one of the byproducts of pride is you tend to elevate yourself by pushing other people down. That's what's called Lashon Hara, by the way, evil tongue, gossiping, murmuring. What you're doing is you are elevating yourself at the expense of somebody else because your focus is on you. Pride is the foundation upon which unforgiveness is built. Think about that for a second. So somebody has done something that you regard as inappropriate to you. The thing that prevents you from forgiving is your pride. So pride becomes the foundation upon which unforgiveness is built. It's the foundation of everything. And so working on pride becomes an extremely important thing. Now, humility, which is the opposite of pride. Remember, pride has a spectrum. It's arrogance on one end and self-abasement on the other end. They're both pride. The opposite of pride, what you want, is humility. And humility is defined in Musar as having the same view of yourself that God has. So God looks at you and evaluates. Okay, this is what she's good at, this is what she's bad at, so forth. So God's view of you represents reality. If you have the same view of yourself that God has of you, you are humble. Now think about that for a minute. Who was the most humble man in the world? Moses. Moses is described as the most humble man in the world. Moses is running a nation of 3 million people. He's calling fire down from heaven. He's doing all sorts of stuff. Moses is not a shy guy, but he is humble because his view of himself matches God's view of him. Another example, let's say that you're the CEO of a company. Well, when you are sitting in the boardroom, you are supposed to fill up the room. You are supposed to be in charge. You are supposed to be making things happen according to your vision because that's why you're the boss. When you go to your daughter's ballet recital, you shouldn't be up on stage walking around while everybody's dancing. You should be sitting quietly in the audience, watching, and applauding is appropriate. So humility is taking up the appropriate amount of space. Moses, when he's judging the people, or when he's talking for God, or when he's coming down from the mountain with the tablets in his hand and he says, rah, and smashes them, he is taking up the appropriate amount of space, which is to say, he is chastening Israel, which is what he's supposed to do. Other times, He's very quiet. So when his two siblings come after him and say, hey, Moses, take a long weekend. We got this. God comes and jerks him up. Moses prays for his siblings. Moses doesn't jack up his siblings himself. It's up to God to do that. Moses takes up the appropriate amount of space. So, where are we as a people? I got this from Rabbi Sacks years ago. Various isms, communism, socialism, whatever, Nazism, treat people, except the elites, as an amorphous mass rather than individuals. So communism talks about the masses, and they don't treat people as individuals, they treat people as clumps. God recognizes the individual. He also recognizes society, but his relationship with each of you is an individual relationship. That's the whole purpose of Judaism and Christianity, is you can have a relationship with the God of the universe. Christians believe you go through Yeshua, Jews believe you go direct. But the whole point is you have a relationship as an individual with God. You are also part of a society, and God will deal with societies also. But the key here is individualism. Now, in the United States, in the Constitution and the Declaration, the United States recognized the importance of the individual. So that's how we were set up. The individual is not just a cipher, one more egg in the crate, just like every other egg. No, we're individuals. Now, like everything else, that can be overdone. That's where we are. Something that starts out good, which is God's recognizing you as an individual, our laws recognizing you as an individual instead of as a member of a class or an amorphous body, starts off as good. But there isn't anything that God gave us that is good that hasn't been corrupted at some point by people. God gave us sex for companionship, procreation, all that kind of stuff, and we have turned it into something else. Same thing with individual rights. So what we have today is what I would call pathological individualism in the United States. And that goes back to what I was talking about 2 weeks ago, where the question is, what is the most important thing? What you want in your heart or God's reality? And where we are as a society is the most important thing has been what you want in your heart. Most of you are too young to remember the 60s. But I lived through them. And all of the music and the culture and everything was follow your heart. That's the dumbest advice you can ever give anybody. That is really bad advice. What you want to do is you want to follow God's word and train your heart so that it lines up with God's word, which means sometimes you have to deny your heart, sometimes you get to follow your heart. But perspective is what you're supposed to have, as opposed to, I want this, and here we go, which is where we are now. Remember Obama. One of the things he wanted to do was transform America, which is to say, I know what's best. I have these programs that will change everything for my vision of the better. Well, his vision of the better is everybody is an amorphous mass because he's a communist. He is one of these isms. And what happens is people who are fond of the various isms try and change society. And I had a cartoon that I was going to project, but I tried to read it from in back and I couldn't read it, so I'm not going to project it. You all know who Calvin and Hobbes was? They're two philosophers. One of them is a stuffed tiger and the other one is a small boy. And Calvin says, I have come to peace. And Hobbes says, oh, really? Yes, I was created to be in charge of the world. And as soon as everybody recognizes that, they'll be at peace too. That's Obama. That's the liberal project. I was created to be in charge, and as soon as everybody realizes that, we'll have peace and everybody will be happy. And that's what I'm calling pathological individualism. Now, one of the things about that project is those who don't play, people like me, are the objects of hatred. It is not the case that, oh, yeah, we don't agree with that. No. You're evil. You're bad. and you have hatred directed at people who don't fall in line with pathological individuality. So you talk to somebody and say, how dare you assume my pronouns, or whatever. Anger, hatred, because you're not playing their game. That's the way it goes. God, by the way, is not impressed with human pride. I'll give you a couple of scriptures. Proverbs 6:16. There are six things that the Lord hates, seven that are an abomination to him. In other words, I've got six, and oh, by the way, I'll give you one more. A haughty eyes, a lying tongue, and hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, feet that make haste to run evil, a false witness who breathes out lies, and one who sows discord among brothers. Notice that it starts with pride, haughty eyes. That's the beginning of it. All the rest of it flows from that. Proverbs 11, when pride comes, then comes disgrace, but with the humble is wisdom. James, God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. God is not impressed with human pride at all. You all remember my quote from that great philosopher John Wayne last week? I'll repeat it for those who don't remember. Life is hard, but it's harder when you're stupid. Organizing your society on something that God hates is stupid. That's why we're having so much trouble, is because the majority of this country has organized itself on something that God hates. That's the definition of stupidity, and we're reaping that. Stupidity is not a good survival strategy. It just isn't. And one of the things we see is things are coming apart at the seams, because the basis on which much of our society is now founded is sand, not rock. So as you go out, contend for reality. Check your own heart. Remember I said, if you're harboring unforgiveness, the foundation on which unforgiveness stands is pride. So if you say that I can't forgive so-and-so, you have a problem with verbs. The verb isn't can't, it's won't. And the reason it's won't is because of pride. And again, if you choose not to forgive somebody, by all means, do it. But understand why you're not forgiving them. You're not forgiving them because of your pride. And at that point, God says, oh, actually, you're part of the problem. You don't want to be part of the problem, which is why God says, forgive. And I'm not going to go into forgiveness. I've done lots of those, and maybe we'll do it again sometime. Maybe next week, never know. But the point is, God will humble you if you will pay attention. God will arrange for everyone to go through chastening, trials, testing, etc. The problem is everybody goes through it, but not everybody recognizes what's going on. God will chasten everybody, believers and unbelievers, but unbelievers don't recognize what is happening to them, and they just get angry. You know better. So as you go through trials and suffering and all that kind of thing, which you will, recognize it as God's process of developing your character. And as James says, count it all joy. Because what that means is God is dealing with you, which is what you want.